What's stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
Why do Catholics worship Mary?
What's stopping you?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
Where is purgatory in the Bible?
What's stopping you?
I think the Pope has too much authority.
What's stopping you? You are called to communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey everybody, welcome again to Call to Communion here on EWTN. It's the program for our non-Catholic brothers and sisters. Do you have a question about the Catholic faith? You're not quite sure to where to get the actual answer, what the Catholic Church actually teaches? We are here to help. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. You can also text the letters EWTN to 58177. Wait for our response, and then once you get it, text us your first name and your brief question. Message and data rates may apply. Those of you watching us on TV today, you can participate as well. Our email address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. Pedro Quiles, our producer, Matt Kabinski is our phone screener, Rich Jesse handling social media for us. If you'd like to ask a question via YouTube or Facebook, we're streaming on both those platforms right now. Just put your question in the chat screen, if you would, please. Rich will see that, send it to us here in Radio Studio One, and we'll take it from there. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
I am well. How are you, sir?
Yeah, I'm doing all right. Thank you.
Interesting question here from Roman, who says, at what point does the honoring of Mary go too far?
Thanks. I appreciate the question. So, at the point that it went too far, it wouldn't be honoring Mary anymore.
No.
It would be dishonoring her.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So sometimes what people ask in what they're thinking of when they ask a question like this is they see Catholics that are just really gaga, head over heels in love with the Blessed Virgin Mary, who are extremely demonstrative in their outward displays of devotion and emotion.
Uh-huh.
And the frozen chosen Presbyterian types that see that, they can, well, that's just over the top. You know, you shouldn't act like that any time ever except at an Alabama football game. Then other than that, it's acceptable. But not if it's not SEC football, you can't do that. That would be inappropriate. No. And I think that's the wrong way of looking at this. So look at it this way. How crazy am I allowed to get in devotion to my wife? Right? I mean, I really don't think you want to put a quantitative limit on that.
I wouldn't.
You know, you don't want to put a quantitative limit on that. And in fact, if I just, came by and gave her a little pat on the back every once in a while and said, good job, wife, that would not be appropriate. That would be way underselling the value of my wife. Okay.
Yes.
Here's where devotion, let's say, for my wife would be inappropriate. Let's say I came in to my wife one day and I said, oh, wife, Savior of my soul, creator and sustainer of my very being, I do worship thee and offer you sacrifice. Here I have brought a garlanded bull out from the field, and I shall slaughter it, and we will have a sacrificial meal in your honor, and we will propitiate you and your magnificent deity, right? That would be very inappropriate, right?
Yeah.
And that's something that Catholics just don't do when it comes to the Blessed Virgin Mary or any of the saints. You will not find us offering sacrifice to the saints or honoring them as a deity. We don't do that, right? There is a case in history, actually it's about 4th or 5th century in Arabia, of a group that no one has ever heard of called the Coleridians. And the reason no one's ever heard of the Coleridians is they sank without a trace. Because what they proposed was worshiping the Blessed Virgin Mary as a goddess and offering sacrifice to her.
Mm.
And the church fathers all said, nix, no way on that one. No, bud, that's heretical. That's pagan. That's polytheistic. We don't go in for that sort of thing. And so the one time I'm aware of in history when someone actually did attempt to worship and offer sacrifice to the Blessed Virgin, it sank without a trace. It got blown up like one of those narco speedboats in the Caribbean. gone. Okay. And so what you're confused about is you see Catholics that they bring out flowers and they dance and they sing and they write songs and they write poetry and all the kind of things that you wouldn't object to, again, if they did it, say, at an Alabama football game, or at maybe in respect to their wife, But somehow, to the Blessed Virgin Mary, oh, no, 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 we can't have that. Sorry, that's the wrong way of analyzing this.
Sure, sure. All right, and Roman, thanks so much for your question. Here's a quick one now from Tammy. Is it okay to miss Mass if I'm afraid I will contract a virus?
Okay, thanks. I appreciate the question. This is nuanced, and it kind of depends on the circumstances. So let's say, are you immunocompromised? And so, you know, if you contract the tiniest little virus, you know, what would be a common cold in us, it could be deadly pneumonia in you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's extraordinary circumstances, right? So, I mean, that would be something to take into consideration, to be sure.
Sure.
Maybe you're not immunocompromised, but maybe you suffer from extreme agoraphobia or some other obsessive compulsive disorder, so that your level of psychological arousal, your level of anxiety is crippling at the thought of being in public. Well, again, that's an extraordinary circumstance, and it is in it and is itself a kind of illness, right, that needs to be treated medically and dealt with and so forth. The long and the short of it is there are legitimate medical reasons to miss Mass, okay? If this is a kind of, garden variety sort of, ooh, icky, they have cooties and I don't like people kind of thing. Well, you know, part of the point of Mass is what the unbelieving James Joyce called here comes everybody, right? Mm. You go to Mass and you have to rub shoulders with people that you wouldn't maybe rub shoulders with at your social club. And it's one of the differences between the Catholic Church and Protestant denominationalism, because Protestant denominations do tend to fall out along very strict, you know, racial, ethnic, economic, demographic lines. Mm. So you typically end up with birds of a feather flocking together. And Catholicism, being the universal church, does in fact involve you in situations where maybe you're pushing into your discomfort zone a little bit. And that's actually a good thing.
It is.
That's actually a good thing. But again, if you have a legitimate medical, and that can include psychiatric problems that make it impossible for you to fruitfully go to Mass, well, then you are excused under those select circumstances. My advice would be take it up with your spiritual director and,
sure,
you know, let them know your situation.
Tammy, thanks so much for your email. If you would like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. In a moment, we're going to get to the phones and talk with Lucy, a first-time caller from Chicago. I have lines open for you as well right now, 833-288-EWTN, if you have a question for Dr. David Anders. 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Before we get to the calls, let me tell you about a wonderful ebook now available from EWTN, absolutely free. It's called The 12 Stations of the Most Holy Eucharist. They're designed to deepen the understanding of the Eucharist, which is considered, of course, the source and summit of our Catholic faith. This free ebook is now available for you at ewtn.com/Carlo Acutis. ewtn.com/Carlo Acutis. Do check that out. And if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN. Beginning here with Lucy, a first-time caller from Chicago. And Lucy is listening on the EWTN app. Hey there, Lucy, what's on your mind today?
I have a question. I prayed the rosary for the first time yesterday and just followed a little booklet that I have, but I don't know if I'm praying it the whole way, and I want to know what it has to include. For the mysteries, does it just include the little summary of like the resurrection or the ascension of the Lord, or is there a specific prayer that has to be said with that?
Okay, great. I understand the question. Thank you so much, and I'm really glad to hear you praying the rosary and giving it a shot. And I want to put your mind at ease right now, because in one sense, there's no wrong way to pray the rosary. You know, I heard a doctor one time talk about the best way to cook vegetables that would preserve the most of their nutrients and all this, and he said,
yeah,
at the end of the day, the best way to cook vegetables is the way that will get you to eat the most of them, right? And the same thing is true of prayer, right? That the best way to pray, is the way that gets you to pray, right? Because the point is to bring yourself into the presence of God in your interior life. And in fact, all the great spiritual directors say if you are praying the rosary and you find yourself caught up in a kind of wordless contemplation of God's majesty, well, better just put the rosary down and go with that, because that's the goal. It's just the rosary is a door. You want to pass through the door into communion with God, and the rosary is just a means to an end, right? So don't get hung up, too hung up on the fine details. Now, that being said, we like to pray with the whole church, and so you like to know if you're doing a devotion, you'd like to be able to go do it with other people, and there's a kind of agreed-on formula, so that's not inappropriate to want to know the right things to do. Now, here's the trick with the mysteries. I remember the first time I prayed the rosary, I had the same thought, and I'm like, oh, I've got to read some big long meditation on the mystery. I have to have some long discourse on the mystery, and that can be very helpful, and sometimes you'll find people who pray the rosary or, you know, recordings of it where you get these nice reflections on the mysteries. But all you really have to do to get into the spirit of the thing is just state the mystery. All right, first mystery, the resurrection. Off we go, our Father who art in heaven. You know what the resurrection is. You know what the resurrection evokes in you. You don't need me to tell you what it evokes in you. I don't have to read some prayer or some long reflection. If I say resurrection of Jesus, right there, just calling it to mind evokes all of that powerful imagery in your mind that you're trying to identify with. If it helps you to read a meditation, go for it. But all you really have to do is just state it. If you come to EW10 and pray the rosary with us, that's what we're going to do. We're just going to state the resurrection, the ascension, sending of the Holy Spirit, sort of thing.
And you know what, Lucy, if you would like to check out, for example, YouTube or the EWTN website, you could look up the Rosary with Mother Angelica. You could look up the Rosary with Father Benedict Rochelle. You could look up the Rosary from the Holy Land with Father Mitch Pacwa. There are some wonderful rosaries out there that will help you along till you get it right, or till you learn exactly the way that makes the most sense for you. Thank you so much for your call. That opens up a line for you right now at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. It is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Let's get to this emailed question from David. Can we use Eucharistic miracles as evidence for God's existence for atheists?
Okay, so, all right. Can you? Sure. Will it be effective? Probably not. All right. Unless it's the atheist that experiences the miracle.
Ah, okay.
All right. So if I'm an atheist and I go to Mass and the priest consecrates the Eucharist, and in an act of impiety, I ought not to do this, you know, if I go forward in communion because I'm scoffing and I'm balking and I'm mocking the whole thing, and the priest holds up the sacred host and says, Body of Christ, and I look at it, and it's a bleeding piece of flesh, and 2 seconds ago it looked like a wafer, I'm going to do a double take and go, what? Let me out of here. You know, maybe this thing is real after all. That might have an effect, right? But the typical response of an atheist to the report of a miracle is to just say, well, I don't think you're reliable. I don't think you're reliable, right? You can always debunk an anecdote by just saying, well, I don't believe the source, right?
Yeah.
Now, I will tell you a true story about not exactly a Eucharistic miracle, but maybe I'll call it a supernatural encounter that an atheist had with the Eucharist. Falls short of a true visible miracle, but nevertheless it was powerful. There was a French journalist who ended up being good friends with Jean-Paul II, whose name was André Frossard. He wrote a book called Dieu existe, je l'ai rencontré, God exists, I've met him, right?
Wow.
And he tells the story of he had to meet someone on a street corner in Paris, and he was an atheist, didn't believe any of it, and he's waiting around this street corner, and he finds that he's actually in front of a adoration chapel, and he thinks, well, that's kind of interesting, and so he pokes his head in the adoration chapel. He has no faith. He doesn't believe in God, doesn't believe in Christ, doesn't believe in the Eucharist. He pokes his head in the door. He sees the monstrance, and all of a sudden, boom, he gets a flash of illumination, and he believes the whole Catholic faith.
Wow.
He stepped in an atheist. He saw the Eucharist. He stepped out of believing Catholic.
That is awesome.
Boom. Right? So that does that happen all the time? No. Does it sometimes happen? Yes.
Well, there you go. David, thanks so much for your email. Let's get back to the phones now at 833-288-EWTN. Here is Eric in Wichita, Kansas, listening on YouTube today. Hello, Eric. What's on your mind today?
Hey, guys. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Real quickly, Dr. David Anders, am I bound by the Roman Catechism, that is the Catechism of the Council of Trent? And if so, how does that compare to me being bound by the current Catechism of the Catholic Church?
Okay, great. Great questions, both. So the Catechism of the Council of Trent, or the Roman Catechism, is an act of the Church's ordinary magisterium, all right? And as such, it's part of the patrimony of the Church's teaching office and teaching tradition. And it's valued, and I think it should be looked at, and it's edifying, and it's instructive. And in some questions, I personally prefer the Roman Catechism to the Catechism on some questions, because it goes into more detail, and it was produced by Dominicans, so it has that sort of typical Dominican rigor, and it's not there to be poetic and evocative. It's there to be descriptive and explanatory,
okay.
And so I think it's of great value, okay? And some of the national catechisms that were produced, say, in the 19th century were based on the Roman Catechism. So if you pick up the Baltimore Catechism, for example, which is produced, wait for it, after the Council of Baltimore, you know, right? It's based on the Roman Catechism. And
okay.
So it's a value. It's a value part of the Catholic tradition. You're not bound to it in the sense that the Church actually has an official position if you are a catechist.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly if you're a bishop. I mean, that's really who the catechism is written for. It's written for bishops and pastors. If you're a bishop and a pastor, and it is your obligation to teach the faith, you are currently obligated to make the touchstone of your catechetical exercise the Catechism of the Catholic Church. Now, that certainly doesn't restrict you from accessing the Roman Catechism or any other resource that you see fit to access. It's just that, all right, the Church says, look, we're going to publish an authoritative norm that should be the touchstone for doing catechesis. Doesn't mean it's the only thing you can look at. Doesn't mean that you can't look at other stuff, right? But this is the authoritative norm for doing mm-hmm. catechesis. It happens to be the Catechism of the Catholic Church after the Second Vatican Council, promulgated by Pope John Paul II. But it, of course, acknowledges, if you read the front matter, it acknowledges the dignity of the Roman Catechism, which was really the first, the Latin Church's first attempt at a universal catechism.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
Eric, does that answer your question? Okay.
Yeah, tremendous. I'm so grateful for you, and I'll see you this weekend at the Catholic Answers Conference.
Oh, great. Yeah, looking forward to it.
All right. Appreciate that. Eric, thanks for checking in from Wichita. Our phone lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Let's go to Jason now in Ann Arbor, Michigan, listening on the great Ave Maria Radio. Hey, Jason, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, good afternoon. My question is regarding into how the Church views habitual sin, especially in regards to grave sin. I lead a young men's group, and I guess the challenges of our generation, especially when it comes to purity, and how habitual sin could maybe alleviate potential mortal consequences. I was wondering if you can kind of speak to that on how it might.
Yeah, I understand the question. Now, there does seem to I understand the logic, which is that if an action becomes so habitual that it's like bordering on unconscious and extremely hard to resist, does the difficulty of resisting it mitigate my moral responsibility in that it would seem to be less freely chosen? That's the logic of the question. Now, there's something really deeply counterintuitive about thinking, if I sin a lot and hard all the time, somehow I'm better off because I'm not morally responsible. Like, you follow what I'm saying?
When you say it that way, yeah,
you know, like
I
if
do.
So what I need to do to get into a position of habitual mortal sin is I need to habitually mortally sin, right? And that somehow puts me in a... The question is, does that somehow put me in a position of greater innocence vis-a-vis my relationship to God than someone who is habitually striving for virtue or, in fact, achieving virtue, right? And that does seem to be something a bit odd about putting it that way, you know? So let me reframe, okay? Let me just reframe the whole question and get at this a different angle, okay?
All right.
The church talks about the wounds of original sin. We have a wound in our nature, okay? We have a wound in our nature. That makes us prone to sin. The wound is not sin, but makes us prone to sin. If you're like me and you're an idiot at the gym, which I am, right? And I'll go in and I'll be like, you know, my shoulder doesn't feel great today. Maybe I ought to lay off those shoulder presses. Nah, you know, and then I go in and I heavy weight and I walk out 5 minutes later and I'm like, oh, okay, now I have to take off for 6 weeks and I've just thrown my shoulder off, right? You can make a wound worse, right? And habitual sin makes the wound worse.
Sure.
So it makes you sicker. It makes you sicker. Mm-hmm. It definitely doesn't bring you closer to God, right? It takes you further away from the question of human flourishing. All right. If the good for the human person is to live according to the highest parts of our nature, those parts that are capable of entering into relationship with God and the true and the good and the beautiful and our neighbor, and I'm taking myself farther and farther away from that goal, that's a bad thing. That's a bad thing. Okay. Now, when you talk about culpability, right, now you're really dealing with the question of, okay, I'm looking at God, and is God going to judge me on the last day? What is he going to do with me, right? And so I've got this motive of fear in my life, okay? And that's definitely part of the tradition. But remember that Christ, with the most wounded people, also expressed the most mercy, right? That mercy is, that judgment is always tempered by mercy in the gospel. And so naturally, when we see a person who, is just bound by habitual sin and vice, like on the one hand, their life is pitiable and we want to help them because they're wounded and they're not flourishing. But at the same time, we pity them. We love them. We want to help them. We say, this person is suffering there, but for the grace of God, go I, you know, take the log out of my own eye. Don't be judgmental of my neighbor. I mean, all those things come into play. And so we should have an attitude of great generosity. And I think that the sinner should be somewhat generous with themselves, although not to excuse their bad behavior, right? And not live constantly under guilt and shame, and the confessional is there for that. I think that it's unlikely, this is my own personal opinion,
mm-hmm.
that in any sin, no matter how habitual, that you could say that the habit had developed to the point where there was absolutely no power of deliberation left. Mm-hmm. I think at that point, you wouldn't be dealing with a rational person. You'd be dealing with maybe insanity, right? Mm-hmm. But that even in the most habitual sin, there may be the tiniest fraction of a moment where a person has the power to say no, right? And therein mm-hmm. lies the moral responsibility. Now, how will God judge that on the last day? Well, God only knows, right? What we need to do is we need to tend to the patient. And the patient here is someone who's deeply wounded and suffering and far from human flourishing, and we want to help them, and with compassion.
Sure, absolutely. Jason, is that helpful for you, sir?
Yes, thank you.
All right. Thank you so much for your call. We are just about at the halfway point here, which means there is still time for your phone call, 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. David Anders, maybe you'd like to explain to us what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. In any event, 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. And of course, you can also text the letters EWTN to 58177, or you could send us an email, ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com.
You know, I want to follow up with one thing on that last call.
Oh, really?
Okay, yeah, but I don't have time because here comes the music.
After the break it is. Yeah. All right. Stay with us. Lots more straight ahead here on this edition of Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on EWTN. Stay with us. It's Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders here on EWTN. Glad you're with us. There's still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. 888-3986. Before the break, we were speaking with a caller regarding sexual fidelity or perhaps lack thereof, and I believe you had a PS on that.
Yeah, so the question was about whether habitual sin, at which weakens the will, could mitigate the moral responsibility. And I was kind of hesitant to answer that in a straightforward way because it would seem to give a pass to habitual sin or make it somehow desirable to be in a position of moral weakness, and I don't want to present it that way. But I do want to come in and address one other issue with respect to the question of guilt and shame and, you know, the fear of God's judgment, and that's what the concern about culpability really evokes, I think. And that is that for a lot of people who are involved in habitual faults, particularly addictions, whether they be sex addiction or drug addiction or alcohol addiction or what have you, they have acquired these things when they are young. I mean, not always. There are people that take up these habits in adulthood, but very often they acquire them when they're young. And there is a profile of the kind of person who is likely to become an addict. You know, they have you know, certain kind of psychological profile, certain kind of family background, certain kind of problems. You know, certain kind of economic status. Often, is you know, one end of the economic spectrum is more likely to get addicted than another. They can have a particular genetic dependent, you know, propensity. All these factors can play a role, none of which are voluntary. None of which are voluntary. So, I mean, if you take somebody who is, let's say, not neurotypical, maybe they're extremely hyperactive, attention deficit disorder, from a broken home in a poor family, in a culture that's surrounded by habitual abuse and drug use and sexual abuse and that sort of thing, the odds that a person in that family situation is going to end up addicted are much higher than someone that comes from another family situation that maybe is not so disadvantaged. And those factors are not voluntary. They're not voluntary at all. And so they are morally irrelevant to the person who's suffering from the addiction, right? And I think would be, clearly, I think reasonably we'd have to conclude, would be mitigating factors with respect to the question of culpability.
Okay.
And, you know, I mean, to put it like really, really bluntly, take somebody like that and compare them to, say, a seasoned Catholic priest who's been in ministry successfully and virtuously for 40 years, who one day says, you know what? I think I'll just take up the habit of cocaine. I mean, like, almost unthinkable.
Yeah,
right? Almost unthinkable, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Clearly, the moral status of those two individuals is radically different. There's no one could deny that.
Thanks for your further amplification on that. Do appreciate that. You know, it's always a kick when we talk about adding a brand new member of the EWTN radio family. Well, this week, guess what? Not one, not two, not three, but four new members of the EWTN radio family. We want to welcome Light of Jesus 98.9. They are in Manhattan, Kansas. Red Sea Radio, adding to their great family there, 91.9 in Hallettsville, Texas. That's in the Diocese of Victoria. Also, Catholic Spirit Radio, 90.5 in Charleston, Illinois, home of Eastern Illinois University, and 94.5 FM in Rockford, Illinois. Welcome to the family from all of us here at EWTN. How about that? Four new members of the family.
I am so excited about that.
Absolutely.
I love that.
Absolutely. Let's go to Josh now, listening in Eugene, Oregon, on one of our very first affiliates, Modern Day Radio. Josh, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask, what is the theological or philosophical reason for why the Orthodox Church does not accept the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception? I know it has something to do with how original sin is transferred, but wondering if you could speak a little bit more on that.
Yeah, sure. There, I think there's several reasons why the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception has not taken hold in Eastern Orthodoxy. One very important objection that the Eastern Orthodox theologian would bring to the Catholic doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is that the Eastern Orthodox soteriology, their doctrine of salvation, heavily emphasizes synergism. Right, the idea that there is a synergy between the divine will and the human will, and humans are cooperative in the process of salvation from start to finish. They don't save themselves, but the grace of God works with them so that they can will and do the good wherein they can be accepted by God, and it's profoundly synergistic, the whole process, as opposed to, say, at the other extreme, say, the Calvinist tradition is completely monergistic. That is to say, God does all the work and you do nothing. You're a passive recipient of what God does on your behalf. You don't do anything. And the Orthodox are at antipodes to that position, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so some Orthodox have objected to the Immaculate Conception on the grounds that it seems to them to not be synergistic, right? Because, it takes place at her conception. Mary is filled with grace from the very first moment of her conception. Well, how can that be synergistic? She didn't do anything to contribute to that, right? And to that, I would say the following. I think if that's your objection to the Immaculate Conception, I don't think you maybe quite understand or appreciate how Catholics think that grace works, right? The Orthodox generally accept the evils of Pelagianism, right, that we can't earn our own salvation, that we do need grace to be saved.
Mm-hmm.
And the Council of Orange also condemned semi-Pelagianism, which is the idea that I essentially earn God's first gift of grace to me, that if I can put myself in a situation where God is kind of compelled to give me grace. And the Catholic Church says, no, even semi-Pelagianism is wrong, that grace is really, you know, God's completely benevolent sovereign choice to bless the soul with this participation in his divine nature. And baptism would be, say, the perfect illustration of the utterly gratuitous nature of grace. I mean, even the Orthodox baby doesn't choose to participate in the grace and the illumination that's extended to them in the baptismal font. And yet, what grace does is precisely empower my synergistic cooperation, right? I mean, Augustine would put it this way, and Orthodox are of two minds on Augustine. Sometimes they like him, sometimes they don't. But Augustine would say that without grace, I cannot but sin. I must sin, right?
Mm.
With grace, it becomes possible for me to not sin. And in glory, it becomes impossible for me to sin, right?
I get it.
And his conception of freedom is that, you know, earlier in the show, we were talking about people that are bound in things like addictions,
mm-hmm.
Who seem to be incapable of doing anything other than sinning, anything up but sinning, and they're not free. I mean, they're miserable, like in a horrible situation when they are bound by their addiction, and it sort of keeps them zeroed in on this very constrained view of life and experience and shuts them off to love and other people and so forth. And so freedom for that would be opening up possibilities by freeing the will from its attachment to sin. And so grace, in the Catholic way of looking at it, actually frees the will, doesn't bind it or constrain it in any way. So I would look at Mary and say Mary was the freest of all people ever to live. She was more synergistic in her cooperation with God's grace than any creature has been or could be, right? Another objection the Orthodox bring to the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is the concept of original sin, and so they do think that we're wounded in Adam, but they don't like the idea of this transmission of original guilt. And to be fair, that's really not the way the Catholic Church holds the doctrine. That is the way that Calvinists hold it. They do think that original sin is transferred culpability. The Catholic Church teaches that original sin is not actual sin, that it's sin only by analogy, and that it's not imputable, right? It does create in us a wound that is a tendency to sin, but it's not itself imputable unless acted upon. And then another objection to the Immaculate Conception on the part of the Orthodox would be that this is a Latin doctrine. This is a Latin doctrine.
Oh, okay.
Since it's not universal in the East, mm-hmm. then it can't be Catholic in the small c sense of the word because it's Latin. And to make matters worse, it was infallibly proclaimed by a pope, and that just really, sticks in their craw. They really don't like it when popes stand up and unilaterally make infallible pronouncements for obvious reasons, because their ecclesiology privileges the ecumenical council, not the Holy Father. And so, for all those reasons, they get kind of bent out of shape about the Immaculate Conception.
There you go, Josh. Appreciate your call today from Eugene, Oregon. Call to Communion here on EWTN. Let's go to Pam now. She's a first-time caller from Georgia, listening on Sirius XM Channel 130. Hello, Pam. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One, I'm just really having a hard time with indulgences, why they're necessary, if there's any biblical basis for them. And I'm also concerned about the present pope. So I'm not a Catholic yet. I was in OCIA. I was very hopeful that after Pope Francis passed away that we would have what I would call left-leaning pope that, due to some events earlier this month at the Vatican, it doesn't seem like that is the case. I'm just very concerned to come under the authority of someone who I don't feel is necessarily aligned biblically with some pauses and stances. So it's really, I'm sorry, my call really is twofold. They're two very separate issues.
No, that's great. I'd love to speak to both of them. Which one would you like me to address first?
Either one, it's fine.
Okay, let's take indulgences, and since that's the first one you mentioned. So, as to whether or not there's a biblical basis for indulgences, you can't separate indulgences from the concept of penance. Penance and indulgences are deeply linked, together with the idea of the communion of saints. You bring those three ideas together to get a full picture. So first I have to talk about penance before I can talk about indulgences. And penance is the idea that once I've been reconciled to God, so it takes place after I'm reconciled to God. One does not do penance to earn God's reconciliation. No. One does penance after one is reconciled to God. That after one's reconciled to God, that in justice, I should make some kind of a stab at rectifying the disorder that my sin brought into the world. And in human terms, this makes perfect sense to any parent, right? Because you have a child, your child does something wrong, let's say my favorite illustration, I've used this 10,000 times, I'll use it again. You tell the kid, do not throw the baseball in the den. Kid throws the baseball in the den, of course, breaks the window, glass goes everywhere. Kid comes to you, lower lip trembling, and says, are you going to throw me out on my heels? You know, am I done? Am I disinherited? Am I no longer your son? And you say, no. I forgive you. I forgive you. I love you. I extend my forgiveness to you unconditionally. Our relationship is restored, right? You haven't earned my forgiveness. I forgive you gratis because I care about you and I love you and I want the best for you and I want to be in relationship with you. So we're good. We're all good. I'm not throwing you out. We're all good. What does the parent do next? Hands the kid the dustpan and the broom. Is that so the kid can earn the father's forgiveness? Absolutely not. Why does the father hand the dustpan and the broom? Is it because the kid will do a better job cleaning up the glass? Hardly likely. Hardly likely. It's because the father knows that that is in the best interest of the son to give him an opportunity to make some attempt, it won't be adequate, some kind of attempt of amends for the disorder. It's not the disobedience that's being amended here. It's the disorder that he brought into the world through the breaking of the glass. And in justice, the right thing to do is to try to make some kind of attempt to clean it up. That's penance. And penance is absolutely in the Bible. Two passages that I love are 2 Samuel 12 and 2 Samuel 24, both cases where King David does something he's been explicitly told not to do by God. A prophet comes and confronts David, and David says, oops, I did it again. I'm sorry. And forgiveness is extended. And then God demands a penance. And David actually understands this. When somebody tries to get him out of it, he says, no. I refuse to offer the Lord a sacrifice that costs me nothing. I'm going to do this thing right. I'm going to do this right, you know. Good examples of penance in sacred scripture, okay? Now, where indulgences come in, let's go back to the kid with the baseball. He's sitting there sniveling away, you know, trying to sweep up the glass, and he's making a lousy job of it. And the father's in the other room, you know, reading his newspaper, waiting for the kid to be done. And along comes older brother who's done nothing wrong. And older brother tells younger brother, hey, bud, I'll help you with the glass. And dad doesn't object. So older brother helps younger brother clean up the glass. And the two of them get it all cleaned up, you know, fetch the baseball out of the bushes and then go out and start playing together. Okay. In this illustration, what the younger brother has been gifted with is an indulgence, right? The merit of the older brother coming to help him complete the temporal punishment due to sin. That's what an indulgence is. In the church's history, indulgences were a product of the faithful's imagination, not an imposition from the church hierarchy. You can read about the history of indulgences in the letters of St. Cyprian of Carthage. When people were subjected to penance by the church, they would occasionally go to the confessors in prison who were suffering for their witness for the Christian faith and ask them to write writs of indulgence so that the bishop might lessen their penance on behalf, you know, for the sake of this other Christian that was suffering vicariously on their behalf. And the bishops said eventually, well, yeah, we'll do that. That's fine. We accept the logic because it's so biblical. Do you remember when God says to Abraham, for the sake of the ten, I will not destroy the whole city? The idea that the righteousness of the few can come to bear on the question of the status of the many and their relationship with God. This is a very deeply biblical principle. It's not only Christ is the supreme sacrifice, of course, without which there's no salvation, but that nature of vicarious self-offering is not limited to Christ in the Bible. There are plenty of other characters in sacred scripture who do that. Moses pleads with God. God says, out of the way, Moses, I'm wiping out Israel. God says, Moses, don't do that. Don't do that for Abraham's sake, for Isaac's sake, for my sake. Don't wipe out all Israel. And God says, okay, okay, Moses, for your sake, I won't wipe out all Israel. Same principle, right? And again, that's the historical origin within the church. Can indulgences be abused? Yes, but here's the dirty little secret on religion. You cannot find any doctrine or practice of the Christian faith or any other religion that is not capable of being abused. You can take the idea of the fatherhood of God and turn it into a horrific tyranny. There's nothing about the Christian faith that can't be subject to abuse. Have indulgences been abused? Yes. Does that mean they can never be used profitably for the spiritual welfare of the people? Does not mean that. And I'm a Protestant convert to Catholicism. I will confess that I do not go after every indulgence available to me every single day. But I have on occasion specifically sought an indulgence, particularly one that inspired me in my Catholic identity or my hope in Christ or my fidelity to my vocation, you name it, right? And one in particular, I remember Pope Benedict issued a plenary indulgence for those that would pray and recite the creed at the place of their baptism. And he's thinking, of course, that, you know, baptism is your entry into the church, and so you profess the faith with the whole church, and it really would help you kind of internalize your sense of being a believing Catholic. And I said, I'm getting me that one, because the place of my baptism was a non-Catholic church.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was filled with significance for me to go back there and think, this is the day I became a Catholic, though I didn't know it. And I, you know, the technical language is I didn't convert to Catholicism. I entered into full communion. Mm. And so the indulgence evoked in me a real sense of my Catholic identity and my identity with the church in baptism and the joy and gratitude I had of my trajectory into the Catholicism. All that was evoked for me by this indulgence, right? So it was a useful spiritual exercise that the Pope offered me, you know, with a motive, of course, of the help of the saints in my spiritual life. And so it was an edifying event in my life. And I have had several other instances in my life where some specific indulgence has, you know, far from being an occasion of superstition in me, was something that inspired me in an act of holiness. And I remember once I had a really good friend whose father died. And I happened to be on pilgrimage in Assisi in Italy at the time. And there was a plenary indulgence that was offered for those that would perform a particular devotion at one of the sites associated with St. Francis. Mm. And I said, I'm going to obtain this plenary indulgence on behalf of the soul of my friend's father. And I did, and I told him about it. And he never, for, you know, 10 years later, he's like, that meant so much to me.
Wow.
That meant so much to me. So again, it was something that was a deeply edifying thing in our lives that helped us bond together in our Catholic faith and deepen our hope and our joy and expectation in his father's holy life. I mean, it was a uniformly good thing is my point, okay? Now, let's see. On to the next question. Some pope says something that one doesn't like. Some pope advocates a policy that one doesn't like. And I know you spoke about the contemporary reigning Holy Father. You mentioned the last pope. But I'm going to answer the question because this is a perennial problem. It's not just something that one would confront with one particular pope. Mm. One always is under the possibility of having a pope with whom one personally disagrees. So what does a Catholic do when there's a reigning Holy Father with whom one disagrees? Okay. So I'm going to take an example from a doctor of the church and a saint and the most prominent, or soon-to-be doctor, prominent Catholic theologians of the last 200 years, John Henry Cardinal Newman.
Okay.
To put it mildly, John Henry Cardinal Newman could not stand the sight of Pius IX.
Wow.
He could not stand the sight of the man. And Pius IX had a long life, which John Henry Cardinal Newman deeply regretted. Okay. And he was not sorry to see him go. And he thought that the man was autocratic and bordering on tyrannical in his public actions. Now, am I concurring in John Henry Newman's judgment? I am not. I'm just reporting what his sentiments were. Okay. And Pius IX was instrumental in maneuvering the First Vatican Council to pronounce the dogma of papal infallibility. And Newman had a very nuanced position on that. He thought, as a Catholic, I confess that the dogma is true. As a man of prudence, I think it was wrong to articulate it. Hmm. And so he took a position called inopportunism, where he thought, there are some true things you don't need to say. There are good reasons not to answer truthfully when your great aunt asks you what you think of her new hat, right? I mean, you don't have to say every true thing. And he thought there were a lot of prudent reasons why it would have been better to refrain, although he was bound by the definition as a Catholic, which he confessed. Mm-hmm. There are other things the Pope did that were not infallible pronouncements that John Henry Cardinal Newman thought were just nuts. And he wasn't afraid to say so, right? And so in that context, he once wrote concerning the papacy that a very Catholic thing. He said, if one were constrained to issue a toast in matters of religion, which would be in bad taste, he believed, but he said if he were obligated to do so, he would toast conscience first and the Pope second. For conscience is the aboriginal vicar of Christ. Mm. And it is good Catholic policy that if any Pope ever asks you to violate your conscience, you are morally obligated to disobey Pope, bishop, priest, president, king, potentate, spouse, you name it. You cannot violate conscience. Now, you should have a properly informed conscience if you can. You should go out of your way to inform yourself. But at the end of the day, if a Pope asks you to do something that violates your conscience, you don't go along with the Pope. Popes throughout history have made bad policy decisions that have sometimes been scandalous. This doesn't start with any 20th century Pope. This starts with the first one, St. Peter. And we know that he was in Antioch, and he was fellowshipping with Gentile Christians. And then when Christians came from James and Jerusalem that were the hardline, let's stick to the law and not hang out with those Pauline people and that sort of business, Peter, out of embarrassment, pulls back and refuses to fellowship with Gentile Christians. Can you imagine how those Gentile Christians must have felt?
Mm, yeah.
Can you imagine when Peter had been eating pepperoni with them? And then James's people come along, and Peter pulls back and refuses to answer their phone calls and won't take their messages and doesn't respond to their emails and cuts them off. How did they feel? They must have felt like dirt.
Sure.
They must have felt like dirt. And he was Pope. And what did St. Paul do? He got up in Peter's face, and he said, "Bud, you are wrong. You are wrong." And I think, Peter learned his lesson, and he came around, right? That was a bad, bad policy move that Peter made, right? Paul did not say, "You're not Peter. You're not the Pope. You're not the Bishop of Antioch. You're not an apostle." He said, "You're wrong."
Yeah, sure did. Appreciate that, and thanks so much for your call, Pam. We have just enough time to get to 9-year-old Carter listening to us in El Centro, California, on the great JP2 radio. Hey, Carter, what's on your mind today, young man?
I'm a girl, and I was wondering. I was at a funeral a few days ago, and a Protestant minister said, he read from the Bible, and he said, half brother of Jesus. And from what I know, I thought that Jesus had no brother, so I was wondering if he actually had half brother.
Yes, thank you so much. So the Bible refers to several people as Jesus's brothers. Now, that could mean one of two things. It either means that Saint Joseph had children from a previous marriage. So some people think that Mary was Joseph's second wife, that his first wife died, and that Joseph had children from a previous marriage who would have been Jesus' stepbrothers.
Okay.
All right, that's one possibility.
Yeah, yeah.
The other possibility is that they were his cousins, and the word brother is used in a loose sense. Like if you say, hey, brother, how you doing today? Right? So it's family member rather than biological sibling. So there are people in Scripture called his brothers. The question is, what is the exact nature of that relationship? And there's different points of view about that.
I'm so glad we could get Carter in today.
Me too.
Yeah, well, thank you, brother. I appreciate that from you.
Yo, bro, thank you.
Thanks, Carter. We could not get to Fred in Texas. Fred, please call us back on our next show. We'll put you at the head of the line. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders. Hey, thanks for joining us today. See you next time here on EWTN's Call to Communion. Have a great one, and God bless.